Welcome to the Mindfulness Podcast. This is Dr. David Black. My guest today is Dr. Natalia Marone, physician at Boston Medical Center and associate professor of medicine at Boston University. Her research career focuses on drug-free or non-pharmacological interventions to treat chronic low back pain. Her clinical trials show that meditation can reduce pain in older adults with chronic pain. Results from this work informed a 2017 American College of Physicians guidelines to add meditation to the menu of treatments for chronic pain. Welcome, Dr. Marone.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to speak to you today.
So you recently received funding from the National Institutes of Health. I came across your work, and it's to support a program that you call Optimum. What a nice name for a program. What do you seek to accomplish with this trial?
Yes, it's really exciting to have received this this grant from the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Medicine. So one of the things that I had wanted to do, you mentioned my work that partially informed the guidelines for treating back pain. So bringing group-based mindfulness-based, modeled on mindfulness-based stress reduction for people who have chronic low back pain. It just wasn't being taken up by primary care physicians. I'm a general internist. I still see patients, and it wasn't being taken up. And I was just asking myself, how can we bring this to primary care, who we are the ones who see the vast majority, is in the top 10 diagnoses for which we see patients, is chronic low back pain. So I was really excited to see this call for applications from NCCIH, which is also under the umbrella of the HEAL, to helping to end addiction long-term umbrella of grants that were funded. And so they really wanted to do were inviting applications for pragmatic clinical trials. So how can you move an evidence-based treatment like mindfulness-based stress reduction from, you know, the rigorous clinical trial setting to the clinic to do that? So I was very excited to see that they were asking for proposals to address chronic low back pain, actually, and for known evidence-based treatments. And so this trial does exactly that. It's out of three sites. So it's Boston Medical Center, University of North Carolina, University of Pittsburgh. We're going to be, and we are currently enrolling 450 people who have low back pain. And they're going to get a modeled on mindfulness-based stress reduction program or usual care. So more pragmatic, because we pretty much are accepting just about everybody who has low back pain. I think so I'm very excited. We're just starting our third year of the trial. So in that period of time, as you know, we had the pandemic, which put a big stop to all clinical research involving human subjects. I mean, we could not bring human subjects into the medical center, period. And I wouldn't have wanted to anyway. I wouldn't have put the participants in that kind of danger. So we actually have shifted completely to an online program. So it was initially intended to be in person, but it's online now. And it's going well. It's been going well.
Yeah, and so I totally get your point. It's such an important one. We find things using research methods and we publish them. And then at the end of the day, we're like, okay, so what? What are we going to do with that information? Because it's so hard structurally to get it into policy, right? And so you're addressing that. That's a huge lift. And I guess I'm wondering, so where does the standard begin then? So we want to add something to what we might call current clinical standard. So what is that for chronic low back pain? And you have a great perspective on this because you're a physician and a research scientist. You're probably seeing this from both sides. And so how do we treat people when they come in?
That's exactly right. So if you were to come to my, to see me in the office, I'd get the history of what happened, do an exam. And, you know, about 80% of back pain is what we call mechanical. Basically, we don't really know the cause. And so So we say that, and as a result, your doctor might say, oh, it's musculoskeletal, that type of thing. And so we basically prescribe physical therapy, which is effective. It's an evidence-based treatment, and it works, and it's great. I'm sympathetic towards integrative medicine. So if my patient's interested in chiropractic care, you know, even before the 2017 guidelines, those were already part of guidelines for chronic low back pain. And then I might prescribe Tylenol or an anti-inflammatory, which is something like ibuprofen or that you can get over the counter. So pretty minimal therapy. And once that doesn't work, which I would safely say, once you have chronic pain, that is not effective for the majority of patients. They will have some pain relief, but then they'll keep coming back to you wanting more pain. And this is part of the reason that we got into the opioid crisis, because patients were now coming back to people like me, clinicians like me, saying, I feel miserable. I can't do anything because of this back pain. And so the clinician might prescribe an opioid. The other treatment that patients received before the guidelines and still do now is surgery. And surgery for back pain that I just described as mechanical, that didn't have a clear anatomic cause. There may be, the patient might have a neuropathy, they might have a sciatica type pain, you know, but many times they ended up with failed back surgery. And so these are the treatments, and all of them, frankly, quite unsatisfactory for people. They were still suffering quite a bit with their back pain. And that's what I had available. I mean, I still practice in a conventional setting. And so a lot of the treatments that are now available are still not readily available to people. So acupuncture works, but isn't always readily available. Mindfulness works, but isn't always readily available. Multidisciplinary pain treatments work, but you have to be at usually a large medical center and good insurance to be able to do that. Massage works, chiropractic works. I think all those things work. So there's more treatments now, but there's a real lack of access to those treatments for, aside from the very simple, here, take a pill, go to a physical therapist.
It's an excellent description you just offered. I'm going to put myself in context here. You tell me if this sounds normal. I think it's very similar to what you said. I'm on the trampoline 3 months ago. My son wanted to jump on a trampoline together. We hit each other's counterweight. He comes flying at my knees, and to make sure he doesn't crash in and hurt himself with his head, I jump backwards and I fall off the trampoline. In that moment, I had never felt something to that degree. I mean, I've gotten separation of joints and stuff, which is terribly painful, but something didn't seem right. My hips just kind of locked up, and I was crawling outside of that gymnasium. I barely could get my shoes on. My son was only three. He's concerned about what's happening. I crawl into my wife is waiting for me outside, and I'm really nervous about this one. I go and get some imaging. You know, I'm like, okay, where do I start? Orthopedic person does some scans, MRI, checks me out, you know, definitely sees that my hips are not aligned anymore, but it's a muscle thing. So I find, you know, there's no structural cause probably, but you've definitely created some muscle and joint issues here, and rest and anti-inflammatories and PT. So I was down that track. And as you said, like PT, I mean, it does help. Just feeling that someone's examining your body and helping you regain some flexibility, heat, cold modules, and all those seem to have helped me. And I'm just giving a personal case. It may not help everyone, and I'm not claiming this was chronic pain. And then I go home, and over about 3 weeks, it took me to recover. And then I'm concerned about chronic pain. Like, okay, what if this turns into something else? I still feel everything about my steps doesn't feel right anymore. I think I get over it to some degree, but then all of a sudden randomly spasms come back. So do I fall into the chronic pain category if like every month, say, I have these recurrent back spasms to where I'm kind of in recovery for a couple days, or is this just something that typically resolves? I wonder where I am because I'm trying contextualizing myself as a possible patient, what we might go through, and then wonder, some people may wonder, am I a chronic pain person? I hope I'm not, but I don't know.
After 3 months, it would be clinically. So most acute injuries, people will resolve within 6 to 8 weeks. So the definition may start as early as 8 weeks when you read some of the medical texts, but for research purposes, we'll say 3 months and most days of the week having pain. And chronic pain is absolutely characterized by what you describe is these, you know, the chronic pain is not constant pain at a high level all the time. If it's that way, that's actually a red flag for something much more concerning, like cancer, for example, or an infection. So can't, you know, it's a sine wave of sometimes the pain gets worse and then it gets better. And what's causing it, you go to the ortho and he doesn't know. And this is where integrative medicine and mindfulness and all these other approaches can really help a patient, because therapists like massage therapists, chiropractors, and also physical therapists who do body work. So there's physical therapists who are trained in the kind of manipulation that chiropractors do, and some DOs also, if they still may do that. So, I mean, clearly there's some malalignment that's happened, and you are now moving into a position. I mean, I'm interpreting, giving you medical advice, take it with a grain of salt, but this is what I would do when I'm listening to my patient. And clearly the original trauma is there. And so a multidisciplinary approach is really important. But now, because this is talking about mindfulness and where mindfulness comes in addition, if I decide acupuncture might help, or if you know a good massage therapist, and I'm not talking about recreational massage where you go to a spa with your friends. I'm talking to people who really know how to do the body work. Or a chiropractor can help with some of those, that trauma that happened that caused probably some malalignment of the ligaments and all of that. But I want to bring up some of your reactions, which we know happen in pain, and that was fear. You started to have a very natural reaction of fear, because while in pain, you are very much aware how it's interfering with your ability to walk, you know, your ability probably to even sit properly, you know, just getting in and out of the bathtub, you know, just getting in and out of a car. Now, routine everyday activities are now limited. And as you become aware of that, one of that natural reaction you have is fear. And mindfulness, what mindfulness can bring to that is that increased awareness of your reactions that are you having that really potentiate the pain. So that we know that fear makes pain worse. We know anxiety makes pain worse. Depression makes pain worse. And yet that's kind of a natural reaction when all of a sudden you can't do what you were doing before, you know, those emotional reactions. So we know in pain theory and also in the central mediators of pain, that is to be expected. Pain is really, it's very complex in terms of how it's perceived. How we perceive pain. So I think you actually described without realizing it very some of the things that happen with the pain response. And then because I'm assuming you practice some mindfulness, you may have found yourself bringing mindfulness to the reactions. You may have found yourself becoming aware of your emotional reactions. But what I really think is amazing about mindfulness is the body awareness that occurs. You may actually start becoming more aware now than you would have prior to mindfulness of what activities you're doing that actually make the pain worse.
Yeah, I think both of those cases are true. And to address many points that you just were mentioning about the different treatment types, the PT, the acupuncture, did that, did both of those, and massage, you know, going through these things and finding how each can alleviate in its own way, at least some symptoms, not to mention the frustration when certified massage therapists, and I had this conversation with a family member who's a certified massage therapist, it's hard to get coverage, insurance coverage for that. And I'm like, really? I can go get a very expensive scan and tell me my back isn't broken, but someone who can actually make me feel way better by the end of the session at very cheap cannot get coverage. It just continues to blow my mind to some degree.
I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And because I work, you know, it's like a county hospital, you know, Boston Medical Center. So we really serve people who are historically been marginalized and underserved. And it's very frustrating. I can't get them treatments that we know are effective.
Well said. It's like we can get people's capture people's responses when they leave a certified massage therapist. They leave the room and say, wow, thank goodness. At least I've recaptured some control over my life, maybe even for the next couple hours. You leave any other offices, you may say, I feel terrible. I just learned right. that nothing's wrong with me and I'm still in pain, right? And we right. we tend to reimburse those that don't do the healing. So I'm on board with you there. And then moving down the line also with mindfulness training, because we are then now asking patients, and as you said, yes, I use many mindfulness meditation practices when I am in a state of pain and outside of pain, because, you know, we want to explore both the goodness that we have in the sensory world and the terror that we have in the sensory world and not be reactive to either of those to the best of our capacities. And it's so true what you're saying, because on some days when I found myself lying on my back, and luckily these are not all days, and I'm highly empathetic with those with chronic pain, laying on my back and recognizing not just the pain, but the limitations of what I can do in those moments. So I have a toddler and a newborn. And I note things like, oh, I can't fully hear what my son is saying right now, right? Because the pain has a volume element. And it tends, if you're in really bad modes of spasms and stuff, to turn itself up so high, you can, may not be aware that you're spending so much attention on that pain that you're not aware that you're distracted from any other thing in your environment. So that's something I tend to try to sit with, especially young kids at home. It's, oh, where's my volume setting right now? Maybe let me try my best to hear into a greater acuteness what my son is saying to me right now, because it's hard to hear over the screen. I call it the scream, because it sounds like the pain is screaming in your ears and you're trying to hear what your environment is saying. So yes, 100%, I do find it helpful. Not that it's going to alleviate all my pain, but that it reminds me about the ways in which I can be functional even though that's still happening. Like, oh, I need to attend to my son right now. I don't want to get lost in pain and negative thought, right? I want to open myself to what someone else needs right now. So, but I see, and I imagine that people with severe, luckily mine's maybe in the moderate and high sometimes, but severe would be so almost impossible, right? Or trying to get to a level where you can tone that volume down to hear what the world is telling you. What do you see there?
You really have, put it beautifully when you say the volume is so turned up, you can't hear anything else. Mm-hmm. And you can, and at least you've had the, you bring mindfulness to it with, so that you had that. For people who haven't brought mindfulness to it, another analogy that a patient used in one of my earlier studies was he kind of used his arms to just, and I'm making a big circle around me right now with my arms. And he said, you know, the pain just encompasses everything, which is your analogy of the volume being so high. And his volume was so high that it took over his life. And this is what chronic pain is doing with folks. It's really becoming the dominant part of their life. It's all that they can hear. He said, after learning mindfulness, he was able to take that big circle that I just drew and then just make it smaller and smaller and smaller and put it where it belonged, which was just in his back. It didn't belong interfering with his relationships. It didn't belong interfering with his just everyday happiness, you know, didn't belong interfering with all of his physical functions. So this ability, this meta-awareness that we engage with, which is increasing our awareness of what we're, our thoughts and emotions and our feelings that we develop, people get that pretty quickly in the 8-week program. And so that they can really start putting the pain back in its place. And I do want to point out, though, that they also recognize that sometimes they can control their pain. People always think that we're just dealing with the psychological, you know, but my findings weren't so much psychological in my trial. It was actual pain relief, actual improvement in physical function. So they are actually engaging those top-down neurons that we have to actually get pain relief.
Yeah, it also, having a daily or whatever people can do for their meditation practice, another way it helps on a personal level for me is uncovering the boundaries when pain is no longer there. And so I can imagine, so it's not the case, I can see, because early in my pain when I was really wanting to deny it, I'm like, wait, I can't fall into this category. I don't have pain. I want to be young. I don't want to have these issues. And there I am, like creating a story about resistance and why I should not have this and could not. And what that does, I imagine, and hopefully quickly resolve that. Who knows? I might run back into it. Was an uncovering when, say, the 3 days of pain that are there, understanding that the non-pain period may come back and being open to that. And then when it is back, fully engaging in that joy that I'm not in pain anymore. So it allows that, I believe, the transition of those boundaries over and over. And then next, you can set a realistic expectation that it might come back. It might come back, but I don't have to live there quite yet, because I'm assuming, who knows, in a month, the spasms might come back. But I want to live here in the present, fully aware that my body can feel good. So it's also in meditation practice, we talk about like the cultivation of those positive sensory experiences as well. So people without that, I fear, and of course I'm empathetic about this, that they would carry through on a cognitive level pain, even in periods when maybe it's not there. Do you see that the case in people trying to cope with pain, though it might be resolving a little bit?
Absolutely. And, absolutely. And everyone's stories are so, I'm always very touched to hear people's stories. They sound simple, but they're transformative. Big aha moments for people who have never learned mindfulness. It's things that someone enjoyed doing their whole life and stopped doing because it seemed to make their pain worse. So remember, my original trial was with older adults. And so this is a woman who her whole life liked making biscuits, and kneading the dough was hard for her. So she had stopped and she had started kneading again. She started making her biscuits again, bringing that joy back, you know, into her life. Another woman talked about gardening. There's this happening on multiple levels, which is why I think in so many ways mindfulness works so well with chronic pain, because it works on all these multiple levels on which pain has an effect. And so there's these decisions you make that you can no longer do something you loved because the pain will get worse. So you stop kneading dough, you stop gardening, you know, you stop activities that you like to do. So on a physical level, you don't do them anymore. And as you learn to, or walk, people talked about going on hikes that they had stopped doing. So the attention to the body that you learn to pay attention to the physical cues of your body through the mindfulness meditations, and particularly some meditations like the body scan, where you're really focusing on paying attention to what your body signals are telling you, as they become more and more aware of what their body is telling them, they're able to work with the volume. I love that analogy. I'm going to use it from now on with the volume of the pain. And so when they're doing something, they can realize that, oh, this actually isn't bothering me right now. I can go ahead and do this. You know, it also has the alternative Or another way of looking at it is when the pain is starting to give you a very small signal, when the volume is really low, that it's a problem. And the beautiful thing about that is when the volume is low, you're much more likely to interfere and intervene, I mean, and actually do something to help it. So now the volume of my pain is low. So I can, maybe I need to stretch right now, you know, maybe I need to just take a Tylenol, you know, right now. Maybe I just need to meditate and do the whole body release of tension that can occur with a mindfulness meditation. And just that alone may help let go of the muscles. When I have a self-diagnosed disc in my back, and it went out a long time ago. I forget, hasn't gone out. It actually went out not that long ago. And I was walking to, you know, a clinic or something. And I noticed how my walking was slightly off and how that was making my back pain worse. And it was because I was focusing on the pain and paying attention to it. And so I was very quickly able to shift. Actually, I think I was wearing 3-inch heels. So at the time, it was making my back pain worse. You think that would be obvious? It was not obvious to me. So the point being, I was able to change and intervene sooner because of the increased body awareness that comes with mindfulness.
Yeah, that early attention, I see that as so important. And also, I found myself in that trap that you were mentioning a minute ago, that there are these small indicators. You know, mm-hmm. Our sensory world is sending us little signals. And I'll notice, and I've done this in the past with this injury, be like, oh, there it is. Well, I am not going to let this come back. And then part of that, I'm not going to let this come back, is just ignoring that. It's like, no, you're not coming. But in doing that, it's so funny. It is the incorrect response to what it's asking for, most likely, which is, yeah, get the massage, get the, it's like the denial that this thing can show its head again, its ugly head. So
once the injury is there, especially a pretty severe trauma, like you might've had, you would expect that there, certain things may bring it back, you know, it can happen, but this is again, where this is truly, really where an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and mindfulness can facilitate that. Absolutely.
And so we talked about some ingredients that are probably at work here, the attentional stance to detect cues, to uncover times in which life might be good and you can sit with that and be okay with that. The world of coping, like how you might address to respond to some situation you're not happy with, like sit, be present, be with yourself, be okay with yourself. Are there any other major ingredients? You think we covered them, or other ingredients that you talk about in your course?
Well, we talk a little bit about the central processing. I mean, it is very complex how we process pain. It's certainly not my area of expertise, but it's absolutely fascinating. And I think to this day, people feel like, and unfortunately many clinicians behave like they don't believe the person is in pain. And so there's this need to get a pill or a surgery to cure it. And the MRI will diagnose it. You know, it will prove to you that I have pain. And it's very, it's hard. It's, what's the word? I'm frustrated that we can't see pain as a mind and body experience like I do. Pain scientists have known this for many, many years. The way we process pain is on multiple, you know, dimensions. But it somehow is taking a long time to reach the general population and clinicians. So I think we're slowly getting there with how we see really the colossal failure, frankly, of providing opioids for chronic pain. But what I wanted just to mention, because it just caught my attention many, many years ago, I was reading an article from like the 1960s, and it was a surgeon who had done some surgery on patients with chronic pain, and they had cut some of the pathways to the anterior cingulate cortex, the ACC. And then they had little descriptors of what the patient said. And the patient said, "I still have the pain, but it just doesn't bother me anymore." And I went, "Oh my God, that is what my participants are saying in the study. They're saying to me, I still have the pain. It just doesn't bother me anymore." You know, if the pain isn't bothering you, that's a big success, you know, in my mind. And so lo and behold, so many of the mindfulness work now, so much of the work within the central processing of the pain is showing how there's changes in the ACC that seem to be correlated with improvements in pain when people experience decreased pain. So it is just fascinating to me how what appear to be fairly simple techniques are really engaging our physiology and our central networks to help us with our experience of pain. So I don't think we can, we can't forget that. I think it's very important.
Yeah, I agree. I'm perplexed by the dynamics of pain as a, in the sensory world. And I'll give a quick example of what I mean there. I could go 3 days, as I said, have a spasm and be on my back and just think I can't walk again. As soon as it all clears up, whatever just happened, I mean, what happened? And now I'll go outside and go for a run, an intense run, and be like, okay, now you're not talking to me. Now you're not talking to me, body, same body. What was the point of that? And that, to me, that's so perplexing. It's the same system, whatever the interpretation mechanism, the mechanical mechanism, how those things join forces to in moments decide these are going to be extreme pain moments. And then other ones, you're completely free to do what you want. And I don't know. It just bothers me to some degree that that whole system like that is possible within the matter of a day.
I agree. I think it's just a beautiful description of how complex pain really is. It is. I'm going to put my doctor hat on, and I think I'm going to take it off because I'm not here to diagnose what's going on with you.
Sure. You're, and that's, I'm fine with that.
But I would say that, you're learning firsthand yourself through your own experience, how complicated pain is, how frustrating pain can be, how much suffering it can cause. And frankly, probably how it impacts your family. Because even when this first happened, you mentioned how scared your little son was when he saw you behaving like, which probably to him, he could probably sense and see and feel your suffering, you know. So I think most people have had headaches or hurt themselves in some way. But when it starts to go more into the severe periods like you have, it's a whole different appreciation of what it means to have chronic pain.
Yeah. And so going back to what we were talking about, getting mindfulness, meditation, and these practices into routine care, we probably need to address what the barrier is. Now, is this a barrier lending to the physicians themselves and not seeing the importance? Does it just go back to our coverage issue? What do you see as something, maybe because we know there might be a big issue at work that we can't change, but do you have a recommendation for maybe your field or cohort as to how to see this, what perspective to have about this?
I think it's a bigger barrier than people who aren't in primary care realize. And that is that we're used to seeing patients one-on-one. So I have a small office, you know, and I see a single patient. You know, mindfulness-based stress reduction and mindfulness-based therapies are frequently taught in a group, you know, in a group setting. And so our clinics do not have a large conference room, for example, to offer, except for our waiting room. You know, they don't have a large space to offer group programs. So, and that's not a trivial difficulty, you know. Primary care is the first line of you know, access to our medical system for most people. And so the clinicians themselves don't have a way to even offer it within their setting because they're not set up for it. So that is not a trivial barrier, actually. And the model of care is we get paid more if we see more people, you know. So we're used to this model of a very short visit and you know. So adjusting how we can see patients in a group is important. And family medicine has a model for that. For about 10 years, they've been showing how you can do group medical visits. And so that's the model I chose for the Optima program, to see if we could do that. Of course, payment is an issue. That's always going to be slower to take up payment by insurance companies. And part of the reason we're doing what we're doing is we have to move beyond the evidence, which is there, but also show how it can be done within clinical settings and potentially how primary care providers can bill for it. There is resistance from patients because the people will still say, but my pain is real. They think if you offer them, you know, a psychological therapy, a mind and body therapy, that you don't think their pain is real. And so they'll tell you, but my pain is real. How is this going to help? So there's barriers from patient perspectives, you know. And clinicians themselves, there's the same idea of this lack of understanding how a meditation like a mindfulness meditation could actually help people with their pain. I think there's some lack of understanding of what's involved. Clinicians like to know what they're sending their patients to. They have an idea what their patients are getting when they send them to physical therapy, for example, but they have less of an idea what happens in an MBSR program. So I think it's important that they start understanding what actually is in the program. So when I give a talk to clinicians now, I'll give them short snapshots of what might actually be taught in the program so they can start understanding it. So it's really on multiple levels that need to be addressed. For it's not just throwing money at it. That's not the complete answer.
Yeah, very good point. Coordination on multiple levels. And perhaps earlier in the training process, I know several universities, including ours, have like an integrative health aspect to the medical training programs. And so young physicians in training are introduced to more mind-body phenomenon going outside of the physical problem itself. So starting earlier, to add to what you're saying, it seems like you're educating people in your cohort and then also educating younger
The lack of students. Education in pain medicine starting in medical school, it's just barely improving now. I had almost none. It was not until I went into research and basically apprenticed with my mentor that I really have a full appreciation of treating pain. And I cannot tell you personally how much that helps me, because prior to that, when I had a patient who came in just complaining about their pain, you know, I felt quite emotionally drained after seeing a patient like that. And it's very true for many primary care providers. So they can really dread that one patient that they have on their schedule for the day. And after learning mindfulness, it wasn't just that I had a method to offer patients to help them with their pain, is I had an approach myself to my patients with pain, so that I started to address their depression and anxiety that was affecting their pain treatment, for example. I was taking a much more holistic approach to their pain, which made me a more effective clinician in helping my patients.
That's an excellent point. We can recognize that getting help through that can sometimes just be a group-based setting where you can recommend patients to who are having any one of those symptoms you're talking about, and they can be addressed in a group. And that's what MBSR has tended to be able to do, because if people were becoming depressed because of this, they can voice those concerns, and other people who are getting anxiety, they voice those concerns, and other people who are getting stressed out at work because of it, they'd all be able to voice those concerns. And then it wouldn't fall on one physician's back about, oh, I have to carry the load, and how come this person isn't getting better? Can I make them better? And worry about all of those things, which why group-based formatting is so important. And then, so what are your thoughts then? Because yeah, the origination of MBSR was a group-based setting. Depending on the program you're in, it could have anywhere from like 5 to 25 people, or maybe even more. And it's voicing a lot of experiences, and other people learn, of course, in those group-based settings. And where we tend to go, and especially post-pandemic, and I've done this with several of my studies too, because you just can't bring in people anymore to your offices, is to go remote. So are you encouraged by this idea that we should be going remote and we can go remote? Or do we want to just keep this in our back pocket as a temporary thing to do, because the group-based setting where people are live has some magic to it that you can't get through telehealth?
I have just been so happy to see the response to participants in the telehealth program. Yes, you're right. There is the support of being in person. It's, you know, I think we even intuitively understand that, because we're meeting each other so many times over video conferencing now. But there is no question that, and I kind of don't like using the word magic, so I don't think it's magic, but there's the magic that happens when people practice the meditations themselves. And the magic is as they start to be able to work with their mind and their racing thoughts, and being able to work with it and find that it's actually workable, and they can promote healthy change. And that we do the meditations in the session itself, but the majority of the work probably is going to happen when they go home and have to put everything into practice. And I think that is one of the reasons why we have seen I've been very pleased with the response from participants with telehealth. There's absolutely a role for telehealth. There was a role for telehealth before the pandemic, and I think we have really seen the value of telehealth throughout the pandemic, and I hope it continues. It's been very effective way to deliver the mindfulness program for participants who, even if they could come in person, they would prefer to do video conferencing because it's a convenience for them. So I've just been very, yes, it's helpful to have people in person, but that's not where the magic of MBSR necessarily happens. It's in the meditations themselves, in the back and forth that happens with the participants, which happens in Zoom. We do it through Zoom for us. And it happens with the scale of the instructor. And those are things that are going to happen regardless of setting.
That's a good point. So in video conferencing technologies, I'll add some nuance to my question. Sometimes people just think, this is computer-based, and so that can't work. It must be annoying. Can't imagine just sitting there staring at my computer. But that is one iteration of what it could possibly be. But more likely, I think for many of us who've been delivering content now so much on telehealth, we realize that there are room dynamics because the technology has become good enough, like seeing the person who talks, seeing their name, conveying information in a way where there can be long-form discussion that is captured well. And even advantages like recording, if it's allowed and necessary, because so many times people want to see previous content. So there are all those advantages. And I see your point about the term that I used, magic. And it's funny, I'm glad you didn't like the term as much. But what I mean by magic is just the unknown, unmeasured element of what seems to make something happen. And we don't know exactly how to name it, whatever that thing is, that dynamic that happens. And you're saying it does happen also in the recording video conferencing room. And so maybe for people who haven't really used telehealth and might be interested in doing a program like this, just maybe quickly tell about like what the structure of this looks like. So you see people's faces, how many people are in the room, and are they feeling comfortable to say private information? How is it?
So we have to actually give people. So first of all, the sessions are as little as 5, as high as 15 people through the telehealth. And even in person, I didn't like to have much more than 10, because those are also people who are very quiet. And once you hit much more than 15, they'll stay quiet. But in a smaller group, they're comfortable enough to kind of speak up. So definitely between 5 and 15, which I think with a 10, that's been true in person. It's been true through video conferencing. And then, you know, they're told what time to meet. They're reminded of the time to meet, and they kind of all join. And pretty much the 8 sessions follow the topics and the meditations that are traditionally presented in the MBSR program. We're not strictly MBSR. We're modeled on MBSR because we take a lot of the stressors, for example, and talk about pain. We talk about about pain theory. How does that relate to mindfulness? That type of thing. And so that's so the basic structure is the same that way. So people come, they join, and then the instructor leads the session. Because it's through Zoom, we actually try to do a tech training for all of those who aren't used to using a video conferencing platform like Zoom. And then they're reminded again during this first session, you know, how to mute yourself, how to unmute yourself. People don't have to put they put the name they want to be called, you know, for privacy reasons. We don't, you know, they can put whatever name they want. We actually encourage people to leave their camera on, but some people actually prefer to have their camera off. The rest of the rules are the same. Like when we talk about privacy and all of that, as you do in any first session of an MBSR program, introductions and why they're there, all of that happens during the first session. So the other thing is that the how to access the meditations, you know, are given to them. They can either do it through a Google Doc, or we have them uploaded on a private YouTube website for some folks, you know, so all of that is reviewed. So in that way, it's pretty traditional. This is what we have found doing this online, though. We've given everybody headsets, you know, so, and we warn everybody about privacy. Some people live in small spaces. And so if there's people around, we need to let then, you know, you'll be aware that other people may hear what's being said. We can't completely guarantee privacy. So we make people aware of that. And then you really do need a tech person behind the scenes, because invariably somebody's internet is dropping. So we just have them telephone in, you know, if they just can't get enough bandwidth to be on. So those type of things are kind of unique to telemedicine. The other thing that actually has worked well is you can do breakout rooms. And once people have gotten to know each other after several sessions, they love this one-on-one with each other, you know. So we'll put people in the breakout rooms, and they really do enjoy that. The other thing that works that's different, and we've had to adjust to it, and the instructors have, participants have such severe pain that they will literally do the session lying in bed. So the instructors have just gone with it. And one thing we have asked people to do, because it was unexpected when it happened the first time, is people will do things that they might not have done in a room. And that is, we have had people light up cigarettes during the sessions. So we've asked people ahead of time now not to smoke.
Yeah, these are very insightful realizations. And I think all of folks who are delivering programs are learning important lessons right now. We're uncovering something we didn't know because we never did it. So, you know, thank you for your work. You know, thank you for focusing on such a challenging topic, chronic pain, and reaching you know, more and more people through various telehealth outlets. Your research seems really important. I wish you the best on completing your trial. Look forward to seeing what happens, and we can conclude for today. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Marone.
Thank you so much for having me. This was just a really fun conversation. You really helped me bring pain to life. So with your stories, your personal stories. So thank you so much for having me and your well wishes.
My pleasure. Great conversation. Thank you. So listeners can find our podcast recordings at goamra.org, goamra.org, where you can support us by becoming a member or a subscriber. That's it for today. Bye now.